Are you not nervous? What gives you the confidence to speak like this towards your country and really put them on the spotlight?
What's the point of being here if you're not gonna tell the truth? People came to schools with their rifles.
Was anybody ever a threat?
No.
I have to ask a question. It's just super uncomfortable to ask.
Go ahead. If you don't do what we say, you're gonna be dead. My reaction is there's a lot worse things than dying.
Do you think it's gonna lead to, God forbid, nukes?
Yeah, we all knew he was a spy.
Terrible spy, by the way, bro. How do you feel about Biden? Do you think he's bought... What's up, guys? Welcome back to the George Janko Show. We're closing in on elections. A lot of people are curious on who's the candidates and are they going to be good for this country. Today, I'm going to be sitting down with Robert Kennedy Jr. and getting to know him as a human being, as a man who wants to take lead in this country. I hope you guys enjoy today's episode. Honestly, I think this is super fitting that it's at my mother's house because my mom and my aunt were named after the Kennedys. So she's Caroline.
Really?
And my aunt is Jacqueline.
Wow.
Yeah, so they told me that like 20 minutes ago, and I was like, oh, cool, I'll start out with that. Thank you so much for being here. I'm actually super excited, and I can't wait to get to know you on a level of, like a personal level. And my first question before we even get started is, I know that before you even started running, you were immediately helping the world from different points from your career path, but when did you decide you wanted to run?
I started thinking about it during COVID because there were times in my life when I toyed with the idea of running for political office because, you know, I've been working in campaigns. I went to the convention, the first convention, the Democratic convention when I was 6 years old. And I was, you know, we were all involved in my uncle's campaign in 1960 that year. And then, you know, I was involved in my father's campaign in 1968. I was 24. I ran my Uncle Teddy's campaign in 1980. I was in every presidential campaign I worked in my whole life. So politics was part of my DNA. And there were a couple of times that I toyed with the idea, I flirted with the idea of running in New York, where I live. My father was senator from New York. When the Clintons left office in 2000, I was looking at the Senate seat in New York, and my numbers were better than anybody in the state. It was my dad's old seat. And so I was thinking of running for it, but I was having a crisis in my own family at that time, and over the long run, in 2012, my wife ended up taking her own life.
I'm sorry.
And I was struggling with some of those issues at that point. So I decided not to run. Instead, Hillary ran. She called me and said, are you going to run? And I said, I'm not going to. And she then asked me to help her, which I did. And then when she went to work for the, when Obama appointed her Secretary of State, the governor, she had to leave the Senate seat, and the governor of New York, David Paterson, called me and he said, I have to make an appointment to fill her seat and I'd like you to do it. So it was kind of a gift for me to be able to have my dad's Senate seat without ever having to run for it. But I was having the same issue at that time and I felt it would be too hard on my family, so I didn't do it. And then I kind of got, you know, politics is a young person's sport, especially if you're going to run for United States Senate. You don't really get any power in the Senate until you've been there for two terms or three terms. That's 18 years before you get a committee chair. So I just said, I'm going to do something else with my life. And I was very content with what I was doing, which was suing polluters and, you know, building a big environmental group. And then during COVID, I saw, first of all, I was being censored, and, you know, very, very heavily censored. So I couldn't go on any TV. I was removed from Instagram. I lost almost 1 million followers. And for telling the truth, you know, there was not a single thing I ever posted that was factually erroneous. I cited and sourced every factual statement I made to government databases or to peer-reviewed publications. I was very careful because I knew they were watching me. And I couldn't go on TV. I couldn't write editorials for the newspapers. And I saw this censorship happening that was disturbing to me because it's such a core value of our country that we that free speech, right? You can't have democracy if you don't have free speech. And then I saw the Ukraine war and that the Democrats, who had always been anti-war, there were two parties always. It was a pro-war party and an anti-war party. And now we just had both parties who were pro-war. And I saw, you know, I watched that war and had a different view from the orthodoxy. You know, I never thought that Putin was trying to take over, was trying to expand his empire. That he had clear objections, which were to the expansion of NATO into Ukraine. Oh, I was watching this and I thought, you know, if I ran for president, I have enough followers now that I could meet the metrics of that they'd have to put me on the debate stage. And the public, and I'd be able to talk directly to the public about, you know, these things that I felt very strongly about. And so I was thinking that, but I knew I could never do it because my wife would never let me run if I wasn't going to win, if there wasn't a clear path to victory. It takes too much out on your family. And, you know, it would be unfair to my kids and everything else. So then there was a pollster, a well-known pollster. His name was Jeremy Zogby. He has a polling house called Zogby. That's one of the original polling houses. And he had been polling my name for about a year. So, you know, when somebody hires you to do a poll, like a politician hires you and says, will you do this poll for me? Usually you get about 30 questions that you can put in that poll. The politician may say, I only need 20 questions. I don't want all 30. So then he'd have 10 questions left at the end of the poll, and he would use those 10 questions and put my name in. And he was getting these very, very strong signals, despite the fact that I hadn't had a good article written about me in 10 years, that it was just a deluge of kind of bad publicity, that somehow my popularity was higher than anybody that he was polling. And I'd never met Zogby before. He sent me an email and he said, I've been polling your name and you need to see these results. And then he came to my house in California and he showed me this and he said, you could win the presidency if you won.
Are you able to be voted for in every state in America?
I can't now, but I will be. I'll be on the ballot. For me, it could cost me, President Biden, President Trump get on the ballot for nothing.
Yeah.
Because they're part of major political parties. Those parties design the rules, and they design rules to make it very difficult for a challenger to get on the ballot. So the rules make it, you know, really, really challenging to get on the ballot in all 50 states. And each state has its own set of bizarre and Byzantine and balkanized rules that, you know, that they that are designed to make it to be an impediment against people getting on the ballot. So, but I'm going to be able to do it. I have now close to 200,000 volunteers. So I think we have more volunteers in our campaign than anybody, and we're able to mobilize them and to move very, very quickly. And, you know, right now, we started New York a week ago. We have 45 days to get 45,000 signatures. And this week, we got 10,000, which is our first week. And we only had about 10% of our volunteers working in the state. By Monday, we'll have all of them in there, and we're going to get our signatures very quickly. And that's the hardest state.
If you keep going this way, I mean, 10,000 in the first week, then you're off to the races.
Yeah.
And do you think that, and something that I love, your political group, you know, you said is we the people. And those are the first three words of the Constitution, and do you think that's why you've been able to get so many volunteers, because you really are here to bring the power back to the people?
Yeah, I mean, that's the theme of our campaign. I like the name of our party. We have a we in some states, there's an advantage if you start a political party. In some states, there's no advantage, so we don't have a political party. But in six states, there's an advantage to start your own political party, including here in California. So we started a party, and you know, most of the names that you would that we originally thought of had were taken. And but We the People was not, so we settled on that, and a lot of people like it.
I really like it.
This video is sponsored by Lifecycle, these little guys that I've been telling you guys about. And let me tell you something, if you're gonna have a presidential candidate on your show, you need to focus and have energy. That's why I took some lion's mane and cordyceps. I am telling you, you put these drops in some orange juice, take it back, sit back, and watch yourself have better energy and better focus. But just in case you don't have a presidential candidate on a podcast, but you have a tummy ache, good, turkey tail. Take some of that. Or you'd like to improve your nails, your hair, your skin. Well, that's shiitake right there. Or you're honestly just trying to relax and watch a podcast. Well, my friend, then that's reishi. Also, you can get all of these together with the biohacker set. So if this intrigues you, hit the link in my description and start improving your body today. Love you guys. Let's get back to the show. You've been interviewed a lot when it comes to your family and how you feel if they were murdered, if they weren't murdered. And then now you have your wife saying, I don't want you running unless you could for sure win. And then you've kind of hinted that it's really hard on the family when it comes to somebody running. What is it that is most frightening? Is it your safety, or is it your like your family's safety? Or is it just kind of like they're going to drag their name and find dirt on them and really haunt them in the media type of thing?
But yeah, it's not a safety issue. I mean, that is an issue that I don't ignore, because, you know, I've had family members who are my dad and my uncle, who were both assassinated, running for, you know, my dad running for political for presidency and my uncle as president. But I don't worry about that. Politics is very brutal, and it's very personal. And President Biden sees me as a threat, and he has about $3 billion. And so he's going to spend hundreds of millions of dollars trying to make me less appealing to the American voter. So the way you do that, they hire private detectives and go through, you know, talk to everybody that you've ever met or had interactions with, and they do everything that they can. It's called negative research, to dig up dirt on you, and then, you know, expose that, and then they have a whole team that is trying to keep us off the ballot in every state, and they employ the person who they have running this. There's two people who are running their team, which is, you know, the team to discredit me. One of them is a woman named Mary Beth Cahill, who used to be my uncle Ted Kennedy's chief of staff, and then she was the head of the DNC. And she is, and so she's part of that team. The other woman is a woman named Liz Smith, who ran Pete Buttigieg's campaign, but her whole career has been about negative research. It's about how do you find things that you can use to hurt or discredit a candidate. She calls it rat fucking. That is her term for it.
Sure, sure.
I think I'm the rat. So, you know, that's hard on your family, and it's, you know, and then... I'm running against the Democratic Party. You know, all of our friends are, most of our friends are people who are in the Democratic Party. Most of my wife's colleagues, you know, the people that she, you know, works with, the people that who are her closest friends, are people who probably don't want to see me run against President Biden. They want to make sure, they're so terrified of President Trump getting elected. And they think that my presence in the campaign may facilitate that. And so they consider me, some of them consider me to be dangerous, and you know, they wonder why would he do this, because he's going to destroy the republic, et cetera, et cetera.
I find that hard to swallow, because I was watching an interview that you had on CNN. It didn't even seem like an interview. It seemed like they were just trying to get you with every single... They would interrupt you and play a clip. And to me, I've never been in an atmosphere like that where I can't just have a conversation with somebody like this. Like, we're getting to know you. We're not trying to pin you. So you have to go through these type of medias to try to get your voice out. You're doing it in an independent stance. And then on top of that, you have family members reaching out on media saying, like, oh, he's doing this to get attention. He's a conspiracist. Like, what hurts you more, that your family retaliates or the fact that you're sitting against a reporter that wants nothing but to trap you?
You know what? The way that I look at this is in a way that it really doesn't hurt me. I think, you know, everybody that I've admired in my life, all the historic figures that I've admired, you know, whether it's Alexander the Great or Alexander von Humboldt, the explorer, or, you know, or St. Francis of Assisi or St. Augustine or people, you know, Alexander Hamilton and or, you know, anybody... Abraham Lincoln, the people that I most admire in my life are people who achieve something, and all of them had to walk through a kind of valley of death where their friends turned against them, where their family turned against them, where people lost faith in them.
Really believe what you're standing on?
Yeah. I mean, you know, Winston Churchill is a really interesting biography, because he spent 20 years in the wilderness, just despised. He was blamed for a big mistake in World War II, for a terrible battle that cost 250,000 British lives, called Gallipoli. And he was wrongfully blamed for that. And so even walking down the street, people would walk up to him who had lost kids in that battle. The soldiers who fought in that battle, who were told to blame him, did that. And he spent 20 years the most hated man in Britain. And then he reemerged later as kind of the guy who saved Great Britain and Western civilization. So, you know, I take inspiration from people like that, that if it was easy to do, it wouldn't be really worth doing.
And not only are you doing it, you're doing it with class. And when they bring that up, you could easily just, you know, say like, oh, my family's crazy, or look at this or look at that. And you could retaliate to try to like discredit them or destroy them. But the first thing that came out of your mouth was you came from an understanding standpoint. I get it. They would love for Biden to win because five of my family members work for him. And I find that to be something that I want in a leader. I want somebody who could understand the enemy or understand the adversary, not one that wants to run into war. One that wants to understand the frustration and stop it from getting to it a level of exploding. What's up, guys? My name's George, and I'm known to be a mother's boy. This Mother's Day, I am getting her hand-arranged flowers. And you guys could do it too if you're in Arizona. Boet de Flor is an unbelievable place to go get flowers from. That if you get anything over $100, you get free delivery, which means you won't even have to go get it because you're lazy, which I respect because I do that as well. So if you want amazing flowers and you love your mother, Boet de Flor's.
There's a story in the Bhagavad Gita, you know, which is, you know, part of the sort of the Bible for the Hindu religion, and it's a story. It's kind of the central story is about a civil war between between the great families in India, and one of the heroes of that book is a guy called Arjuna, and he's the sort of leading general and the prince who's on one side in this battle. His charioteer is a human iteration of our avatar of the god Shiva, and it's a very wise charioteer who is advising him, and he goes to for wisdom and advice, and Shiva never reveals himself until the very end of the book that he's actually the god Shiva. But by this time, Arjuna knows who it is, and he has to be brought to the front line of the battle. And when he's on the front line, he sees that arrayed against him are all of his brothers and sisters and all of his cousins, and his entire family has taken the other side. And he breaks down at that point, and he says to Shiva, "I can't do this. It would be morally wrong for me to fight my family and maybe kill them. And it can't be what, you know, the gods want me to do. This can't possibly be right." And Shiva says to him, he says, "You know, I've already killed you all." And he said, because he's telling him that, you know, time is actually static, you know, and he's saying to them, "You have a duty. You have what he calls dharma. Yeah. It's what you were created to do." And that, he said, "You were created to be a fighter. If you didn't fight, it would be shameful. You'd be vile, even if the fight is causing injury to people that you love or whatever." You know, a lot of the choices that we make during life are correct choices, and yet they hurt people who we love. They hurt people who don't deserve to be hurt. You know, if you break up with your girlfriend because you know this relationship is not right, you still love her, but you know it's not right, so you do the right thing, and breaking up was hurtful. Yeah. And yet it's the correct thing to do.
Sometimes the best thing has the most pain.
Exactly. And so, you know, dharma is what we were put here to do. And that, you know, we can't be constantly accounting for all the causes of what we do. We have to focus on what we were meant to do. And I feel like, you know, in some ways I take wisdom from that story. Because I believe that what I'm doing with this campaign is important. You know, this effort, somebody needs the effort to bring Americans together again.
And they need to. It's divided. Yeah. And a house that's divided can't stand.
No.
Do you believe that your father and your uncle would vote for you in this election?
I do. But I also, you know, make allowances for the fact that other people
feel like it would.
Feel like they wouldn't. You know, I'm utterly convinced. If I weren't convinced in my soul that they would, then I would not run. Because I think, you know, they were committed to, you know, the best part of our country, the most idealistic part. But I don't begrudge my brothers and sisters for holding a different opinion. And, you know, my father and my uncle don't belong to me anymore. When they don't belong to any of us. You know, when Lincoln died, his Secretary of Defense, Seward, said to him as soon as he passed, he said, "He belongs to the ages now. He doesn't belong to us anymore." And I think my dad and my uncle, you know, belong to every American in there. And they, you know, have to come to terms with their own assessment about what the right thing to do and what those men would be doing or what Washington or Lincoln would do in this situation.
I agree, and I think that's a righteous standpoint you're standing on. But at the other hand, I have to be a human and say that if my father, who's right here, who you got to meet, and he was telling you he's a Syrian and he has the same alphabet as the Jews. That guy right there that's so charismatic and fun, if other people got to see him from a camera and from what he did with his work, to me, it's like, you guys can't tell me your relationship with him is more than me. He changed my diapers. He raised me. He made me the man I am. So my opinion of him is greater than yours. And if anybody else thinks otherwise, I think that's foolish.
Yeah, well, I have 10 siblings who, you know, my dad also changed their diapers, and they disagree with me as to how he would feel about my campaign. So I have to make my own peace with that and do it without carrying around resentments or grudges or feeling like I have to win the argument. I don't have to win that argument with anybody.
Did you pick up this talent from the debates you guys would have at the kitchen table when you guys were young?
And my dad would come home every night, and his father did to him, Joseph Kennedy, who was my grandfather, did that every night. He would pit his children against each other and say, you know, you take this side.
Real healthy.
Yeah, in a debate.
Yeah.
They wanted to measure their mettle. He yeah. wanted to see that, you know, he wanted to hear them make arguments. And, you know, two of his sons, there was a famous, my grandfather was the opposite of a socialist or a communist. He did not like communism. He didn't like socialism. And at that time, the greatest intellectual in the Western world who was a purveyor of socialism was a professor at the London School of Economics called Harold Laski. And my grandfather sent his two sons, his two eldest sons, Joe and Jack, to go study under Laski, to learn his point of view, because he felt we shouldn't be scared of ideas.
That's
we
good.
Should be able to debate every idea. And
what's there to be scared of? If you ponder, we actually just had this conversation. And this is just my relationship with God. Sometimes as a human, you get scared to bring up that dark part of your heart, but you have to weigh things out. It would only be honest. Like, you have to be able to speak your heart and your mind, because you don't want it to bury down here and then you built resentment and you don't grow in the thoughts that you want. And then also you can't be called out if you're wrong. And so if you're ready to be worked on and work with others, it shouldn't be something you're scared of. That's only pride. If you're worried about being wrong, that's the problem. But I like the fact that you guys were pinned to like stand up for your beliefs and stuff like that.
Yeah, and we, you know, we were taught to debate different issues. I remember debating LSD, whether, you know, it should be legal, the Vietnam War, you know, anti-ballistic missiles. These are all things that we were asked to debate about at the kitchen table or the dining room table. And then, you know, the dining room table in our house was an important place. My father came home every night early from the Justice Department. Then he went home back to the Justice Department after dinner. And he was an incredible war historian. He would come and tell us, you know, on vacations, he'd take us to the battlefields of the Civil War, the Revolution, like his mother had done with him. He talked about the Peloponnesian War. He talked about, you know, all of these battles that changed history, Genghis Khan, and so we were raised excited about that. The Charge of the Light Brigade, you know, all of these, you know, historical events, and my father would teach us about that. We had to come on Sundays. We had to come prepared to with a biography, so we would memorize the biography of a famous person, and then we'd talk about it at dinner, or we would have to memorize a poem. And so we had kind of a high level of discussion at the dinner table. There's now, you know, 11 kids, and my mother, father, they're often house guests, but there was only one conversation allowed. You couldn't start talking to the person next to you. Everybody was participant in the big conversation, and then he would ask us to debate different things. And to debate them with passion, with knowledge, using reason, all the tools of logic, and then discuss how we did. But we were also taught that you can't hate the person that you're debating. You know, it's an intellectual exercise, and that, you know, you have to be able to have disputes with people without, you know, and continue to love them.
You have to respect.
Yeah. And so, yeah.
An important, beautiful tool to learn as a child. I mean, it's like, you know, your childhood really prepped you for this time in your life. And do you feel like you're applying that now with your siblings because you guys aren't really on the same page politically? Has that tarnished your relationship?
Yeah, no, I it hasn't. I mean, I love my siblings. I know they love me. In fact, you know, I know that when they were with President Biden this time, that they asked him, a number of them told me that we asked him to give you Secret Service protection. So, you know, that's an act of love, right?
How do you feel about Biden?
I always got along with Biden, and I liked him, and he's, you know, he's kind of a hail fellow, well met. He's kind and in his discourse with you. But he's always, to me, I've always disagreed with his approach to war. He's always been, you know, of all the Democrats, he's the most pro-war. And I think that's one of the reasons that the party really likes him now.
What's up, guys? The Heart of David finally came out with its second drop. I just wanted to show you the website and see what it looks like over here. We got the Pray for Your Friends hoodie, and we restocked with Made by God. So if you guys were trying to get your church boy shirt or a hat, and you haven't been able to get your hands on it because we were sold out, we are now back in stock. And thank you guys for collecting these pieces. I'm excited to keep adding on to them.
I have to ask a question. It's just super uncomfortable to ask because I've never been like...
Go ahead.
Do you think he's bought... Do you think he's bought in the reason why he's making these war decisions and sending our children to war? Is it?
Well, I don't think he would ever consider himself bought.
Nobody's considered. No one wakes up being evil, but throughout life, like you make decisions.
I think that happens in a way that is insidious to, you know, the entire political class. They know that. Their campaigns are being financed by BlackRock, State Street, and Vanguard, that BlackRock owns Raytheon, General Dynamics, Northrop Grumman, Boeing, and Lockheed. And that, you know, Upton Sinclair made this great observation that it's almost impossible to persuade a man of a fact if the existence of that fact will diminish his salary. So people, you know, tend to convince themselves of a worldview that will profit them, and that, you know, that those are all reinforcers for your worldview, that you can make compromises with yourself, with your conscience, with your logical mind, if you know that there's going to be a payoff. And I think that's what happens to the political class, that they understand that there's a that there are guardrails on the dialogue we can have. There's a concept called the Overton window. And the Overton window is the window of possible discourse. So all of the disputes take place within these two walls. And that if there is an option outside of those two walls, you're not allowed to talk about them. We saw that a lot during COVID, where there was a permissible discourse that could occur about lockdowns, about masks, about vaccines, about everything. And there were simply things that you could not talk about that you would never see on TV. You know, you could mention that Wuhan lab, but you had to also mechanistically say these obligatory words. That's conspiracy theory.
Do you think it's as strong as it used to be, or do you think they kind of stopped as much because they knew they were getting called out on it?
You mean on COVID?
I'm just talking about on just persuading people not to speak about things. Like, you speak about something, and now your next few posts are not going to be visible to some people.
Yeah, I mean, I think the COVID stuff has calm down a little, but I think the same thing is happening. You know, it happened during the Iraq War. You know, we weren't allowed to say, well, wait a minute, Saddam Hussein didn't really bomb the World Trade Center. Saddam Hussein didn't really have weapons of mass destruction. You weren't allowed to say those words. And you know,
when it's like farther out in time and they don't care, the time's already passed.
Now it's, oh, we made a mistake. You know, everybody thought that, you know.
They called you a conspiracist when you thought like this? Or?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a little tough. And then they paint you to be
crazy
evil.
Person.
Yeah.
But the same thing happened with, you know, Ukraine is that, you know, you have these comic book depictions that, Vladimir Putin is trying to conquer all of Europe, and he's like the modern day iteration of Hitler, and he's, you know, this is ambition. And it's the same. We get these formulaic comic book supervillain descriptions of each of these guys, of, you know, Saddam Hussein, of Vladimir Putin, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
You know, Xi. And, you know, my uncle always said, my uncle, President Kennedy, they did the same with Khrushchev. And he was like, he said to the CIA at that point, to Alan Dulles, you mean there's nobody in the Kremlin who disagrees with Khrushchev? No, it's a monolith. They all want world communism, and this is what they want. And my uncle was like, I don't buy that. It has to be like Boston politics where, you know, inside, they're all fighting with each other. Even, you know, inside the state house, they all have their own agendas. And he wanted to know what was driving Khrushchev. And the CIA had no idea, because at that time, the KGB had a mole in Langley. So they had a spy who's never been found. But every time they got a spy in the Kremlin, that spy would be murdered immediately. Because there was somebody in Langley telling them. So the CIA, when my uncle came to office, had no idea what was happening in the Kremlin. And they just had, again, these kind of comic book depictions of what they thought was happening, but they were all not true. And my uncle, that's why my uncle ultimately put a hotline in directly to Khrushchev. He said, if you want peace, you have to be able to put yourself in your enemy's shoes and understand what's driving him. And he put a hotline in so that he could talk to Khrushchev directly and say, what are you thinking of? And, you know, when I was growing up on the Cape, there was a red phone in my uncle's house. And we knew if we picked it up, Khrushchev was going to answer. No other president had done that.
As a kid, we were like,
yeah.
I can't believe he answered.
Yeah, well, my father had a buzzer in his office to summons J. Edgar Hoover into his office, who was the head of the FBI. And, you know, we went in there and pushed the button a couple of times. And you know, Hoover came up really angry. But nobody ever picked up that red phone, because that was, like, off limits. But my uncle and Khrushchev began writing secret letters to each other. And when I was growing up, there was my house, which was Hickory Hill in Washington, was like the satellite White House. And it was always, there was always congressmen there, Supreme Court justice, ambassadors, heads of state, you know, Cuban revolutionaries and, you know, Green Berets. And it was just always filled with actors, comedians, but it was the centerpiece of life in Washington. And but one of the people who visited our house frequently was a GRU spy called Georgi Bolshakov. And the GRU is the military intelligence. It's like the KGB, but the military branch of the KGB. And he was, my father had met him and mother had met him at a party at the Soviet embassy. And they were immediately told by the State Department, by the CIA, he is a spy, you should stay away from him. But he was very charming. He was kind of he had like a build like you, you know, he was strong, but he could do the Cossack dancing, you know, and he would come to our house and eat lunch with my...
Did he know that you guys knew?
Yeah, we all knew he was a spy. And this was, you know... this is
terrible spy, by the way, bro.
This was at a time when the James Bond films were just coming out. So it was, you know, for us as little kids, it was like, wow, we have a real Russian spy in our house. And he would do rope climbing contests with my dad and push-up contests. And he was an athlete. You know, he was sort of stout and short, but really strong, super strong. And he was always laughing. And, you know, my mom and dad really loved him. And Khrushchev trusted him. And Khrushchev wanted to end run his own, you know, diplomats, diplomatic corps who were all, you know, spying on him. And so he began writing letters to my uncle, and then he would get Georgie to deliver them. Georgie would deliver them in a folded New York Times, which he'd hand to Pierre Salinger, to my dad. And there are secret letters. There were 26 of them. And they began talking to each other almost like brothers, you know, because they were both in the same position, kind of a mirror image of each other. They were all surrounded by war hawks. Both of them were war heroes who had fought. You know, my uncle had been lost at sea for 10 days. His boat had been, you know, he was the skipper of a ship that was cut in two by a Japanese destroyer. He rescued his crew and, you know, and barely survived the search by the Japanese. And then Stalin was going to purge Khrushchev, and he had actually ended up in Stalingrad, which was the worst battle of World War II, the most brutal, bloody, people eating each other, you know, really, really hard. They ate all the cats, all the dogs, all the horses in Stalingrad. They began eating each other, and, you know, the Russians held out to the end and then finally beat the Germans back. Khrushchev was there the whole time. So both of them had seen the ugliest part of war. Neither of them wanted to bring their country to war again, and they were completely surrounded by an intelligence apparatus and military brass who considered nuclear war with their opponents not only as inevitable but desirable as soon as possible. And they both, you know, they found each other and they kept the country, or their countries, from going to thermonuclear war. So, and that's because they were trying to understand each other. And nothing like that has happened with Biden and Putin.
Do you think it's going to lead to anywhere that, God forbid, nukes?
I would hope not. But, you know, I think we're so much closer to it than we should have ever come. And I think our military policy is being dictated by mercantile interests of these big military contractors rather than what's good for the American public or what's good for the world. And it's, you know, we've spent $8 trillion on wars over the past 20 years, and every country that we have meddled in is worse off than we started. You know, the Iraq war, we spent almost $4 trillion on, and Iraq is now worse off than we found it. We killed more Iraqis than Saddam Hussein. Iraq today is just a, you know, incoherent battle between Shia and Sunni death squads. We created ISIS. We drove 4 million immigrants up into Europe, where they've destabilized every country in Europe, all the Western democracies. The Brexit is a direct result of our, you know, meddling in Syria and Iraq. And BRICS, which is this, you know, coalition now of countries that is trying to end the dollar as the world reserve currency, which will be totally devastating to our country.
You were saying something about putting something on the blockchain. I just read this. Did you just mention
this? Yeah, I said that, I guess, yesterday.
Yeah.
And I'm going to put the whole budget on blockchain. And
so are you...
Because, and that means that every American, anytime they want, will be able to see how every dollar that they've paid in taxes is being spent. So, you know, you'll have millions of eyes on our budget, and if somebody is spending, you know, the Pentagon hasn't passed an audit in 30 years. And, you know, nobody's looking at their audits. But what if you had 200 million Americans looking at every line and saying, hey, why do they pay $16,000 for a toilet seat? Why are they paying $900 for toilet paper? You know, those
are you not nervous talking about this type of, like, because I meet very, very like tough dudes, and they, like, the behind cameras, they're like, yeah, we never bring this up, and you're just blatantly talking about it on camera. Is that because you walk around bodyguards around you all the time? Like, what gives you the confidence to speak like this towards your country and like really put them on the spot like that?
What's the point of being here if you're not going to tell the truth? What's the point?
I respect that.
They don't have to struggle paycheck to paycheck. They don't have to, you know, can't afford health care. They don't know what to do in a crisis because they can't save up money. And God forbid something happens and they don't have a backup, you know? And I saw that you are trying to change that and you want to help everybody be in a better place. And it's amazing, you know, it's what everybody needs right now.
Yeah, but I mean, one of the things, you know, the points that I made is now our government is using fear.
Yeah.
In order to induce compliance and to control us. And Franklin Roosevelt in 1932 said, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. And he said that people repeat that, but they don't even know what it means. What it means is he was watching right then, because we had a global depression.
Yeah.
And he was watching what was happening in Europe, where you were getting these strong men who were appearing, like Franco and, you know, in Spain and Mussolini in Italy and Germany, and that they were using fear to induce compliance to their populations. And on Eastern Europe, you had the rise of left-wing totalitarian, right-wing in Western Europe. left-wing in Eastern Europe, but those tyrants like Stalin and, you know, others were doing the same thing. They were using fear to induce compliance.
The churches do that as well. Like,
I mean, everybody, that,
yeah,
of course.
It's like the number one trick that they use. It's a very strong sword.
Right, and that, but you know, and we saw people using it during COVID. We saw our government saying everybody needs to be scared and the media cooperating with them. And, you know, my reaction to that is that, oh, if you don't do what we say, you're going to be dead. Mm-hmm. My reaction is there's a lot worse things than dying, a lot worse things. And that Americans need to remember that. And one of those things is, you know, is living like a slave. We had a whole generation of Americans in 1776 who said, you know, who put their lives on the line, their properties, their reputations, their fortunes, and said, I'd rather lose anything in order to give my children these Bill of Rights. And we have to be willing also to make sacrifices to hold on to our Bill of Rights. During the Civil War, we lost 659,000 people to keep this country together and to maintain those constitutional guarantees. And yet in 2 years during COVID, we just give them all away for nothing just because somebody scares us.
Oh, and also it's not fair that if somebody is scared that I have to be scared. Like, why is it that he's scared that it makes me scared? I'm not scared of what he's scared of, but now we all have to move off of somebody else's fear. That's, to me, it's brainwashing and it's not free. It's slavery at a whole different level. Speaking of freedom, do you think that the election is something that could be rigged, or is
I do think elections could be rigged, and I don't think people should be punished for saying that. Of course, we should all be worried about that. You know, the machines can be hacked. And whether they, I'm not commenting whether they were or not, or whether they have been, but, you know, in 2001, virtually every Democrat in our country believed that that election was stolen from Al Gore and given to George Bush. And, you know, when they finally did count the Florida, you know, in September, the big news outlets led by the New York Times actually did a recount, an actual recount of all of the votes in Florida, because during the middle of the, you know, they were counting, if you remember what happened, there was a recount demanded. And because the machines had said one thing happened, which was Bush got elected, but the paper ballots were indicating that people didn't believe that. So they started to count all the paper ballots, and the Supreme Court made a ruling freezing it.
Well, isn't that like kind of a red flag? That's a red flag. Baby, are you cheating me? No, I'm not cheating on you. Let me see your phone. No, absolutely not.
Yeah, and I think it was a 4-3 vote by the Supreme Court, so it was very narrow, and the people who voted were, and it was party line vote, so it was not a good example of, you know, our judicial system. Because of that, the New York Times and all of the other news syndicates said we're going to pay millions of dollars to have all those paper ballots recounted, and they recounted every vote in Florida. And that was completed in September of 2001. It was completed 1 week after 9/11. And so the story was buried on the 10th page of the New York Times, because by then you couldn't report about anything except for 9/11.
Now, 9/11 covered a lot of things for people.
And it turned, so what they found is that Al Gore actually did win the vote. And, you know, anybody can look this up. This isn't a conspiracy theory. The New York Times printed it. But no, everybody ignored it then, because we had to rally around our leader, which George Bush. So, but most Democrats believe that election was stolen. And then in 2004, I won an award or an article that I did that year that showed how the election again had been stolen away from John Kerry. And, you know, Congress voted on that. And, you know, I think 140 members of Congress said, yeah, it was stolen. In 2016, Hillary says that the election was stolen from her. To this day, you can look up her interview in The Atlantic. And then, you know, Bernie also, Bernie's followers also believe that the election was stolen from him. So it's not unpatriotic to say an election could be stolen in this country. And I don't think we should be looking back and saying, was this election stolen or was this not? It's just going to have each other's throats.
We
should look forward and
to
say,
the future.
We're the richest, greatest technological country in the world. We're also the world's model democracy. Can't we design a voting system that nobody's going to question? That everybody just says, he won and he won fair and square, whatever it is. And, you know, I've pointed out that we have, you know, not too far from here, there's a city called Las Vegas. That this extraordinary city that was built almost entirely on being able to create machines that never make mistakes, that can count, right? And there's there are, and that they never ever make a mistake. And we have ATM machines on every, you know, block in New York City and every street and
they'll
Phoenix,
never make a mistake.
And they never give you more money than you ask for, right? So we ought to be able to make a voting machine that can't be hacked. I don't think you can hack an ATM because people would be doing it all the time and you'd read about it. So I have to imagine that you could design a machine that can't be hacked. No matter what, let's have paper ballots too. So you have paper ballots and you have the machine, and that if anybody has any question, you can retrieve those paper ballots and you're going to get a recount, and nobody ever is going to question our elections again. Let's just do that. Let's get Republicans, Democrats all together in a room and say, let's forget about all the disputes about who won this one and who won that one. And what do you need? What do your followers need in order to make sure that nobody questions the vote? And what do my people need? And they'll be able to do that. And the problem is they never do that.
It's very hard to speak for somebody's circumstance. Like, for example, if I didn't grow up a certain type of lifestyle, I can't make comments on certain type of cultures because they'll say, what do you know? You've never came from there. So when you stand up for things like gun rights, there's people that have lost family members from mass shootings. They've had people that have been murdered from guns. So their opinions are very, very strong on anti-guns. Your family has been murdered by, I'm sorry to say this, but has been murdered by guns. How is your feeling towards weapons in America?
I mean, my feeling is exactly as you stated it. I have, you know, my uncle, my father were killed by guns, but I also, you know, I have spent years of my life. I was born in Virginia. I lived 2 years in Alabama. I lived a year in rural South Dakota. I was in rural Alabama, Lowndes County, and you don't get more rural than that. And I, you know, so I've spent a lot of my time, and because I'm, you know, a hunter and a fisherman, I spent a lot of my time with people, with rural people in our country, who have this very, very visceral relationship with gun culture, and they see it as essential to who they are. And, you know, the idea of taking a gun away from that person is, for them, it's existential. It means the end of their freedoms. So I believe in the Constitution, including the Second Amendment. And, you know, as president, I'm not going to take anybody's guns away. You know, I wasn't really raised in that culture, but I understand it, and I understand that those feelings need to be respected, they need to be understood, and that if we're going to get some kind of what people would call sensible gun controls, you know, that people mentally ill can't get them, but we need to all come together on that. And right at this point, we're all so polarized that nobody can come together, and that anything anybody does is just going to increase the polarization. I say this too, and you know, this is controversial, and people come after me because I've mentioned this before. We also need to understand what's causing these mass shootings in schools. It's utterly unacceptable that any kid in our country gets killed by a mass shooter. And it's happening every 21 hours. We're seeing mass shootings in our country. Why is this happening? It does not seem to have anything to do with an increase in guns. The mass shootings began over the last 20 years, and there was no dramatic increase or dramatic gun legislation that went through during that time. When I was a kid, we had gun clubs in my schools, and people came to schools with their rifles. And yes.
Was anybody ever a threat?
No, and nobody, there never in human history.
Do you think it's video games or?
Well, let me say that, because I think that's something that should be looked at.
Well, when I saw Grand Theft Auto and everybody, there's a 7-year-old kid having fun beating up a prostitute and shooting at a cop. To me, I'm like, that can't be healthy. Like, you know what I mean? Like, right. You know what I mean? Like, just can't be healthy. Like, back in the day, like, my parents would be very involved with what I'm looking at and watching and being absorbed by. Like, so now these kids are just buying games online with mom and dad's cards, and they have no idea what they're playing. They have no idea what they're doing on their iPads. I think social media and video games, if it's not properly controlled, is dangerous more than drugs.
Yeah, and I don't know how, you know, my kids even navigated it. And, you know, the availability of porn and all that stuff on the internet.
That's fine.
Crazy.
But, I'm just kidding.
No, no, don't get
you leave
that.
My porn out. I'm just kidding. No, that's terrible.
But you know, it's hard. Our kids have a harder time navigating all this stuff than we do. And, you know, with us, our parents that get out of the house, lock the door, and don't come back until, you know, it's dark.
Yeah.
And the dinner bell rings. And then, you know, and all they had to worry about was that we'd step in a bear trap or something out in the woods, or, you know, fall in the creek or whatever. But, you know, now there's all kinds of stuff happening in your house, and you have no idea what world your kid has entered. So, you know, something happened, because there's never been a time in human history when strangers would walk into a gathering of children, or even strangers, and just started shooting them. That just has never happened.
Was there as much guns back in the day?
Well, there's always been, you know, a proliferation of guns in our country. There wasn't a sudden proliferation that explains why that started happening. And there's other nations that have, you know, comparable levels of guns to us. For example, Switzerland. Now, there's a gun in every home in Switzerland. It's a law. And
wait, they make it mandatory for you?
Yeah.
Why?
It's self-defense. There's a, you know, they have a self-defense system called the Canton system, where everybody, I think everybody in the country is required to have some military training and then to keep a weapon in their house. The last mass shooting they had was 21 years ago. We have them every 21 hours. So what, you know, it's not the guns, right?
What do you think it is?
I think we need to look at that. And actually, NIH should be looking at it. NIH has a rule that they passed in 1997 that forbids any money being spent to study the etiology of gun violence. So they don't want to know. And I will change that rule, you know, when I go in there, and I'll make them study it. But there's, you know, there are a lot of, it's outside the Overton window. There are things you can't study. You can't study the link between vaccines and chronic disease. You can't study, you know, the links between high fructose corn syrup and the obesity epidemic, because there's somebody powerful that they don't want to expose. And so
that's
the kind of studies
though.
They ought to be doing, they're not doing. And this is one. 1997, you can go look it up. They adopted a rule, a regulation, that makes it illegal to spend any federal science money studying the etiology and the origins of gun violence. Now,
This is crazy.
Yeah, so
the problem, there's a root. And so if you're not finding the root of it, you're not going to fix the solution. We're just putting
of course, Sean, of course. And now, here are possibilities. When the Columbine was one of the first, you know, acts of mass violence by a stranger, you know, against strangers. And I believe there were five victims or families of victims in that attack who sued Prozac and said, you know, that the killer was on Prozac. Prozac has a black box warning that says it causes homicidal and suicidal behavior. All the SSRIs do, and in fact, in their clinical trials, there were terrible, terrible signals of homicidal and suicidal behavior. Very, very devastating signals. So, you know, there's a widespread suspicion that this epidemic of gun violence that we're seeing is being caused by the proliferation of SSRIs. I think there's 120 million prescriptions written a year for maybe Prozac, 120 million for other SSRIs, benzos, and another 120 million, you know, for Adderall, right? And so you've got a whole generation on these drugs that have black box warnings that say this causes the kind of behavior that you would associate with these mass shootings. So that's one issue. You know, another is you know, just social media. Is that to it? But nobody else has the addiction to SSRIs that we have in this country. And that could explain why the gun violence is different here than elsewhere. I'm not saying it is the answer. I'm saying it ought to be studied. It's hard to study. You can't really study it without NIH help because of the HIPAA law. So when these mass shootings start, you know, isn't the first question you would ask at a mass shooting, was that shooter on SSRIs? When an athlete dies on the playing field, don't you want to say, was he vaccinated? They'll never print that in the paper. They'll never tell you the answer. The first question that comes to your head, was he vaccinated? You know, did he drop dead on the playing field, the healthiest person that you could find? Was that mass shooter on SSRIs? You'll never find that out because the HIPAA laws make it illegal to give that information. So you need NIH to come in, and you know you need them to adopt a rule that says in mass shooting cases this is a question that you know we're going to answer, and then do the study of all the mass shooting cases, and you know you can easily find out, you can easily go back in time, because each one of these shooters had an HMO. And they were, you know, they had an insurance plan that was paying for their, you know, their drugs if they were on them. So let's find out if they were on them or if they recently got off them. Because that is one of the things they found. When you recently got off them, that's when a lot of the suicide, the violent behavior, starts. It could be social media. It could be video games. It's something happened and the guns do not seem to be a covariable, because there was no increase in guns. There was no increase in, you know, gun legislation. Something else changed. Something else changed that we need to explain. And it's happening, the fact that it's happening here and it's not happening in other parts of the world, that's a tip. And that is, you know, something that needs to be taken into consideration.
I'm so glad that you are and that you've looked into that.
What my question is this, and not to be disrespectful, I hate when I talk like this because people in the comment section are like, oh, shut up, blah, blah, blah. But I'm new, so I'm asking dumb questions in this field. If we have so much money to help our neighbors, which, you know, thank God we are in a situation where we could help neighbors, and I don't know the reasons why we would or what we wouldn't. I'm just saying we have the funds and the abilities to help our neighbors. That being said, why are we not putting more security in schools? And that could, I feel like that could just save the issue right there. Like, and I might be stupid for saying this, but like a lot of people are like, arm the teachers. Dude, the teachers have enough on their plate. They're raising our future government. They're raising our future kids. They're raising our future, like, I don't know if he's going to be a president or a lawyer or a doctor, or maybe somebody who's going to fight this vaccine shit, or like, I don't know what it is, but they have enough on their hands. A guy who's teaching English has never even shot a 9mm. He doesn't need to be strapped, but if we could send billions out to a different country, why can't we put police officers in that county in schools? So if, God forbid, a child that's a lunatic that comes in with that idea, before even the first round goes off, he's down on the ground immediately. Is this a stupid question to ask?
No, I mean, I asked that question too, and I've asked Gavin DeBecker, who is, you know, probably the leading security guy in the country, you know, how do you do this? And, you know, until we identify the cause of it, that's what we need to be doing. I mean, people don't walk with guns onto airplanes. We'd figure that out. And if we have to do the same thing at schools, let's do it. These are our most precious assets.
9/11 happened one time. Now I can't bring a water bottle through the airport. You know what I'm saying? I'm not trying to make a joke, but like we had how many children's dropped to the ground for them to make a reason to help these children? I don't know why they need to figure out why it's happening before you solve the problem. Like if we're at an intersection and there's car accidents, there's kids dying from this, all that, I'm not going to sit up like, let's keep making this happen until I figure out why this is happening. It's like, no, let's shut down the street right now and figure this out later. To me, it just...
I mean, to continue that metaphor, if you're bleeding out, you don't need to figure out exactly what made the cut. You know, let's stop the bleeding, and then we'll figure it out.
Exactly. I feel like there's a lot of common sense that's not so common. You were younger at the table. You were talking about LSD, and you were, like, debating all of this. But then I also read an article that you're for marijuana.
For legalization.
For legalization. And then that you wanted to help people that were in prisons that were locked up for marijuana, and they're locked up for their whole life. I feel like they should be let out. I feel like if we make it a rule where it's like, oh, this is not that big of a deal anymore, then we should be taking the people that we thought was a big deal out of it. That was my one question. My second question is that I read somewhere that you said that this will help people get off of other drugs, and I actually would love to understand your point of view on that.
No, I mean, look, I've been in recovery for 40 years. So I'm not somebody who believes that you can fix something inside of yourself with something that's outside, with a pill, a potion, a powder, you know, or anything. And, you know, if I could, you know, stop people from taking drugs, you know, by waving a magic wand that, I of course I would do that, you know, but, you know, we're a nation of freedom. And right now, we have marijuana that's essentially legal in many states, but it's Schedule I federally, which means that you can't report your revenues. If you're in California and you have a dispensary, you can't pay federal taxes on that. You can't report your taxes. You can't even bank that money in some cases. So, you know,
where do they put the money?
They literally keep it under their mattresses in many states.
That's so funny. They literally did that before, now.
There's an entire industry that manages cash for people who run these dispensaries, you know, and they that manage the huge amounts of cash that they have. And, you know, there's not even that many ways you can spend cash. You know, how many houses can you buy with cash or cars or whatever? So they're, you know, the people... And many states who are in that industry have really a difficult time dealing with all of the cash that they're producing. And what I would do is I'd move it off of Schedule I so that we can start collecting taxes. And then I use 100% of that revenue to build rehabilitation facilities all over this country where people can get free treatment for drug addiction. And we got 106,000 kids who died last year from overdoses, maybe fentanyl, mainly fentanyl, but a wide range of drugs. We got an entire generation that is feeling dispossessed, alienated. They're losing their connection to community, and they're losing their hope in their future. Their love for this country, and a lot of them are turning to drugs, and we need to give them places where they can come for free and learn to live in communities again, to get reparented so that they, you know, take away the cell phones, take away their screens for a year or more, and get them to talk to each other and get them to relate to each other and teach them skills, teach them the trades, you know, teach them how to be an electrician, a plumber, a roofer, a HVAC technician, a welder, and teach them all of these new trades that we used to teach in high school that kids aren't learning anymore. And these are the skills that can't be stolen from us by AI. You know, if you've got a toilet that's broken upstairs, you can't call a robot in the middle of the night. You need an actual human being.
Not yet. Give Elon a few months.
Well, those are the last jobs that are going to get, you know, AI'd out. So, you know, we need to teach kids the trade. We need to teach them again how to live in communities. And we need to have places. And, you know, right now, the biggest industry in our rural areas in our country are prisons. And I'm going to change that. I'm going to put these wellness farms all over our country where people grow their own food, organic, good, high-quality food, which have their own industries there, which have, you know, a home building or whatever, you know, prefab houses, whatever, so that they can learn a skill. And then they come out of there after, and they can stay as long as they need to, and they come out after a year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, and they have a life, and they know how to relate to other people, and they know how to live in a community, and they can live without drugs and, you know, addiction. And I've seen, you know, examples of this. The big example that I use is a place called San Patrignano's in Italy. It's in outside of Bologna. And it's an extraordinary place with 2,000 kids on it who they all come out with a skill. They have an apparel shop there that makes purses for De La Valle, for Prada, for Gucci. They make hand-painted wallpaper. They make they have dog kennels so people can learn to, you know, deal with animals. They have a couple thousand acre vineyard that makes some of the finest wines in Italy. They have a bakery that's very famous in that part of Italy, and they have furniture factories, and kids go and work there for 5 years. They never use a cell phone. They never use a screen. There's benches everywhere where they actually sit and talk to each other, talk to other human beings like this. And they come out of it. It's amazing. So
those are such important fundamentals, and they make you well-rounded and able to, you know, be able to attack anything in your life, you know. And speaking of farming, that's actually something I wanted to...
I was waiting for you, bro. I was like, come on.
It's something I wanted to touch on, because for me, food and health is something very important, something that, you know, helped me my health a lot when I was younger. And I think that food is our medicine. And nowadays, when it comes to agriculture, I mean, I can't even trust organic food I'm buying from the store, because I know how much, you know, different things it's going through and the politics in it. And it's so sad. I feel like I can only have true healthy agriculture if I were to grow it myself in my backyard. And I saw that that's something that you're really passionate about. And I would love to hear on how, you know, you plan on changing that and fixing our farms.
Yeah, we're really big fans of that.
Yeah. I mean, we have 1,000 ingredients in our food now that are banned in Europe.
Exactly.
The biggest problem we have in this country is the chronic disease epidemic. When my uncle was president, 6% of Americans had chronic diseases. Today, 60%.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and these are neurological diseases like ADD, ADHD, speech delay, language delay, tics, Tourette syndrome, narcolepsy, ASD, autism, autoimmune diseases like rheumatoid arthritis, juvenile diabetes, lupus, Crohn's disease, all these exotic diseases that I never heard of as a kid. Nobody in my generation ever heard of, and then allergic diseases. I never knew anybody with a peanut allergy.
Yes, you know, yeah.
Right. Why do 5 of my 7 kids have allergies? Why is eczema suddenly explode? In 1989, all of these things hit that year. What happened? And you know, clearly we're mass poisoning this generation, the obesity epidemic. We're mass poisoning them with, you know, high fructose corn syrup, with glyphosate, herbicides, pesticides like atrazine, neonicotinoids, fluoride, cell phone radiation, all of these PFAAs, PFASs, these flame retardants that are in our furniture, they're in our children's pajamas, and many of them operate on the same biological pathways. They're destroying our immune system. They're stressing their mitochondrial energy. and they're destroying their health. And it's costing us $4.3 trillion a year, five times our military budget. So I'm going to end that. And I'm going to identify what the exposures are that are causing it. And there's only a few culprits out there. And I just mentioned most of them. Mm-hmm. And we're going to end it.
That would change the world significantly.
Yeah, it'll change the world. And we're going to, you know, I'm going to start, rather than incentivizing farmers to switch to GMOs and monocultures and, you know, and chemical and agriculture and oil-based fertilizers, we're going to incentivize them to use regenerative agriculture to regenerate our soils, which is the big solution for anybody who's worried about climate. The most important thing we can do is to have soils that absorb carbon. We can absorb all of our carbon budget if we have good, if we restore our good soils in this country. And we can create better foods. We can stop flooding. We can, we're going to have better health as Americans. And I'm going to, that's one of my principal focuses. Do you follow Mark Hyman or?
Mark Hyman?
Yeah.
I like Barbara's. Do you know Dr. Barbara?
She's Australian.
Yeah, I really like her.
What's her last name?
No idea.
It's just Dr. Barbara. Okay.
What was it?
Barbara O'Neill.
Oh, okay.
My mom in the kitchen.
She gives so much wisdom, and what I really appreciate about her is that, again, it's coming back to the fact that food is our medicine and how we heal ourselves naturally, and what we put into our bodies will be the outcome of everything when it comes to our health, you know?
Yeah.
And we can heal ourselves naturally. We don't need to be taking all these prescription drugs and all these extra things. Like, this is the root of it, you know?
Yeah, you know, Peter Gosch, who's one of the most important scientists, epidemiologists in the world now. He's the co-founder of the Cochrane Collaboration, which is the biggest institute, 30,000 scientists collaboration for 30,000 scientists who review clinical trial data. And he did a study this week. He just published a study this week that showed that the number one cause of death now in the United States of America is prescription drugs. 5 years ago, he did a study that showed that it was the number three cause of death after cardiac arrest and cancer. Today, it's the number one cause of death. So, you know, the drug industry is not making us healthier. It's making us sicker. And like you say, food is medicine. And if we change our diet, we can change our health.
Speaking of food, my mother has cooked a delicious meal for us. But before we head out, I have one last question. I pray that your road gets you to where you're at, and wherever God needs you to be, I pray that if you are the president, if you're not the president, that whatever God needs you to do, that you complete your mission. And I was in the sixth grade. I was dressed as John F. Kennedy, and I just remember this one line, and it says, "Ask not what your country could do for you, but what you could do for your country." If you are president, how could you get the Americans to start worrying about their neighbors again and stop being so selfish?
Yeah, you know what I said? I don't think Americans are selfish. I think, you know, when you get scared, you tend to start thinking more and more of yourself. I think we're a generous people and that we're a kind people. And I think we need to step away from the fear. And we need to step away from the dishonesty. We need to have a government that tells us the truth again. My first day in office, I'm going to issue an executive order saying that if you're a federal employee and you lie to the public, that you lose your job. And I'm going to enforce that. So I'm going to stop the federal government from lying to us. And I think that, you know, what I said when I declared my candidacy 1 year ago, I said, I'm going to try to convince Americans, if I do my job, people are going to forget that they're Republican or Democrat, and that they're just going to remember they're Americans, and they're going to start seeing everybody in this country as their brother, their sister, their family member. And I think we've got to get back to that.
I'm praying for it.
Thank you.
God willing. Thank you, Robert, so much.
Thank you very much.
I really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Shauna.